Good morning, Council. While you're coming forward and setting up, I'll just call the case. Our next case is A23-0735, State of Minnesota versus Jamal Wendell Graham. Council, while you're getting ready, I'll just let you know that you each, if you already don't know this, have 15 minutes for your principal arguments. Council, for appellant, you'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose to use it. I'm not trying to rush you. Are you ready to go?
Your Honor, I believe I am ready.
Okay. We are live streaming this argument, but we maintain just an audio version for our public website later. And if you could each please state your name and the party you represent for the record when you begin your argument, we'd appreciate it. And we're ready for you, Council.
Thank you, Your Honor. My name is Nick Colombo, an assistant Isani County attorney appearing on behalf of the appellant, the State of Minnesota, this morning. And good morning, and may it please the court. Now, members of the court, I would like to start off by kind of giving the court a brief roadmap of what I'm going to talk about this morning here. First off, I'm going to address the issue of whether or not the state has shown that there is going to be a critical impact on this case if it goes to trial based upon the district court's order. After I finish addressing that, I will then proceed to the merits of my arguments and why the district court abused its discretion in doing so. Now, first off, members of the court, I'm going to start off with arguing about how the appellant, the state of Minnesota, has shown that there will, in fact, be a critical impact upon this case if it proceeds to trial, and if the respondent's witnesses are, in fact, allowed to testify via Zoom. Now, the state does not have to prove necessarily that the error would be completely devastating to the state's case, but the state just has to prove, you know, that there will be a significant impact, and they have to prove that clearly and unequivocally. Now, members of the court, the reason why I believe the state has reached this oftentimes difficult threshold is, for one thing, based upon what the state sees as several different federal cases that seem to indicate that in-person testimony is the best and most preferred way of eliciting testimony in court. Now, we see here, especially through the Thornton case, which is cited in my brief, where it indicates, you know, that there really is no substitute for in-person testimony. We see that that case itself cites several other cases that seem to echo this same sentiment, that in-person testimony is the best and most preferred way as opposed to Zoom or remote testimony through other electronic means. Now,
it seems to me that it's actually better for the state to have the critical defense witnesses in the case appearing via Zoom rather than live. I mean, if what you're saying is true, that live testimony is preferred, doesn't it help the state more than hurt the state?
Well, Your Honor, I do think that it will hurt the state, and this kind of goes into my next point here as well. I think the reason why, you know, in-person testimony is preferred is because, you know, if the witnesses are appearing in front of Zoom, then what the jury misses a lot, I think. And most critically, I think the jury misses, you know, the demeanor of the witnesses that are on the stand.
So is it your position that the jury is more likely to find these witnesses to be credible alibi witnesses because they will maybe be missing some of the nuances that they would see otherwise with live testimony? Is that what your argument is?
I think that is correct, Your Honor. It really comes down to, I think, a lot of those nuances, you know, facial expressions. The tone of their voice, I think, can be incredibly distorted through electronic means. And I think, you know, t- tying it into why the state, you know, would want the witnesses, prefer the witnesses to be in person rather than Zoom,
is the fact that... Was there any issue here about the integrity of the proceedings? I mean, was there any, or would there have been any procedures established to ensure that somebody wasn't standing there with a gun next to these witnesses' heads while they're testifying, but it's out of view of their computer camera or cell phone camera or whatever?
Yeah, I don't think there would be very many procedures to, you know, prohibit that from happening. I think that's certainly a risk, you know, that there could be some sort of duress going on off the screen or other things. And I think going along with that, there could also be the risk for the quality of the video being poor, you know, and that would be important as well. I'm not sure how we would...
But that can be dealt with. I mean, that's not the issue, right? If the technology isn't working, that doesn't seem to be very persuasive.
Well,
in establishing critical impact.
Well, I mean, I think because that part of my argument may be more hypothetical, that doesn't really help as much with the critical impact portion of my argument. But I think what does is the fact that, you know, we have several of these federal cases that seem to, and even, you know, the federal rules of civil procedure, Rule 43, Parents A, that seem to suggest that, you know, well, virtual testimony is kind of inherently of lesser quality than live in-person testimony. And I think that's the part of my argument that I think speaks towards the critical impact part of this argument. And I realize, you know, there's several different factors, right, that could contribute to the quality of the video testimony. But we see consistently these cases ruling, you know, that, yes, this type of testimony is inferior to live in-person testimony. And I think that's one of the ways that the state gets to that critical impact here.
So can I ask, I mean, I guess two questions. One is, it's hard for me to square the idea that remote testimony can be consistent with a defendant's right to confrontation, and yet, when it's on the other side, it's so critical to the, it's so much worse that it actually it has a critical impact on prosecution. I'm having trouble squaring that idea. And secondly, what is the test then for, I mean, there is a test on the under the Confrontation Clause, obviously, where there can be a balancing of two interests. What is the test that you think that exists under, with respect to defense witnesses?
Yes. So as to your first question, Your Honor, I think that this can be squared with that because under that test, under the Tate case, you know, it really gives very limited exceptions to the Confrontation Clause, extremely limited. And I think that, you know, the Tate case involved, you know, it occurred during the COVID era, you know, when we had so much uncertainty in regards to, you know, what was going to happen with in-person testimony, things of that nature. So I think that's one important piece here, you know, is that while those cases do allow remote testimony in very limited cases, the fact of the matter is that those situations are limited. And we see also, you know, in the Craig case that's cited, another big issue there was the fact that it was a victim of child abuse, and it didn't seem like the victim in that case was going to be able to get through their testimony without being able to have a remote option. So Your Honor,
are there any cases that you've been able to find where critical impact has been found dealing with the procedure in which the testimony is going to be taken? I mean, this is not a Confrontation Clause case, so I don't think Craig has anything to do with this case. But I suppose it's what the district court looked to for some kind of guidance. But is there such a case? Because almost all of them deal with the exclusion of evidence that the state wants to introduce. There may be one or two cases where the state was objecting to evidence, but it was the evidence. I mean, these alibi witnesses, that you're not objecting to their right to testify. It's just by what mode and where from, right?
Yeah, that's correct, Your Honor.
Yeah.
And Your Honor, I have not found, you know, a case specific to this, you know, set of facts here. So I do think we're kind of facing, you know, a situation of first impression here on that. But nevertheless, Your Honor, I do still think, you know, that same analysis, you know, is still applicable here, despite, you know, the absence of the state's evidence being rejected.
Are you making an argument that your ability to cross-examine these witnesses is somehow going to be impaired because they're appearing remotely?
Yes, Your Honor.
How?
Yes, Your Honor. So I think in terms of cross-examination, you know, one of the biggest impairments there would be that, you know, that's the state's opportunity to really be able to test, you know, the witnesses' stories. And that kind of goes into, I think, all of the other factors that I was talking about before, the demeanor, you know, being able to examine how they, you know,
but,
react
but you'll be
under,
able to ask
the
same questions, right? I mean, it sounds like your argument boils down to the ability of the jury to observe everything that might be observed in person.
And I think that's certainly probably the biggest part of it, Your Honor, the fact that, you know, they're going to be missing so much in terms of this. And
via Zoom, though? I mean, it's Zoom we're talking about here, right?
Correct, Your
Honor. So how do you miss so much via Zoom?
Well, Your Honor, I'm going to go back to kind of one of the methods. I think that the district court alluded to this when they made the order that the witnesses would appear on a big screen. Now, I don't think that, you know, that's really sufficient to be able to, you know, make that for the jury to be able to make that analysis in terms of evaluating the credibility of these witnesses. Now, perhaps, you know, if, you know, I'll give an example of, you know, we've had a lot more court trials via Zoom, right, and traffic and petty misdemeanors. Now, in those situations, you can kind of have a more personal experience there because you have your own computer screen usually, and you're able to see the other people through the computer screen, of course. And in this case here, it appears that, you know, these jurors are going to be sitting in the jury box, and they're going to be looking at a screen from across the room. So I don't think that, you know, that is really sufficient or to be able to make those determinations that the jury has to make. And another major point that I want to make here is that I want to keep in mind what the subject matter that these individuals are going to be testifying about. They're going to be testifying about an alibi, essentially an alibi defense that the respondent is going to be making. And I think that's critical here because I think in large part this trial is going to hinge upon whether or not the jury finds those witnesses credible or not versus the testimony that the alleged victim in this case is going to present. So, Yar, because I think just the sheer importance of the subject matter that is at stake here, I think it's critical that these witnesses are brought in person for this trial.
So can I ask, counsel, getting back to my question, what is the test that you would apply?
Yes, Your Honor. So
because you're suggesting sometimes it might be okay. And, you know, I referenced the Confrontation Clause because, of course, under Tate, you know, the second prong was, is there an ability to test the reliability? That was what was by remote testimony. And, you know, it goes through an analysis of cross-examination, all of that. But you're saying there's not an adequate ability to test reliability by Zoom. But sometimes there might be a case where a district court permits Zoom testimony. So tell me when that would be.
Yes, Your Honor. So I think some of the cases in our brief kind of reference this to, you know, I think the Thornton case, then Rule 43, Parents A, really, I think, gives us a strong framework in order to be able to evaluate this. I believe the standard kind of used there is kind of good cause, and there needs to be compelling circumstances.
Didn't the district court essentially find good cause here? I mean, the district court went through that analysis and, you know, assessed why the witnesses weren't able to come because they didn't have the resources, excluded the testimony of another witness, didn't find there was good cause for her to appeal, to appear. So didn't the district court essentially apply the test that you're asking for?
Well, Your Honor, I think, the district court, could have applied a similar test to what I'm asking for, but I think, a key difference here is that I think this does not rise to the level, required. And the reason why I don't think
to me, that sounds like an abuse of discretion argument that you're making there. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, Your Honor. I would argue that it's an abuse of discretion here, just based on the fact I don't believe, indigency of the defendants is necessarily a sufficient and compelling reason to find good cause under these circumstances. I think there's certainly other alternative ways that, the defense, could pay for their way over to Minnesota from Colorado. There's certainly, I just don't find that to be very persuasive in terms of being good cause, I guess. So that's part of my argument as well.
Is there any actual evidence in the record that they could not afford to travel?
Your Honor, I don't believe there was any sufficient findings of that. And I see I'm just about out of time. Thank you, Your Honor.
Sure, you'll have time for rebuttal, 5 minutes. Counsel for respondent.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Anders Erickson, and I represent the respondent this morning, Jamal Graham. We are requesting that this court dismiss the state's appeal because the state has not established that there will be critical impact on the state's ability to prosecute its case. In other words, the state has not established that a witness and the method that a witness is testifying will actually affect how a jury would reach its decision in this case. Importantly, this is not a case where the district court ruled on the admissibility of the substance of evidence, as Your Honors were mentioning earlier. This is a case regarding only the method in which that witness will testify. This is important to critical impact because in Tate, the Supreme Court made clear that Zoom testimony is okay. It's acceptable. Witnesses' demeanor and credibility can be evaluated by the jury through Zoom, and that's in a case where there's...
I'm going to tell you what... is really concerning to me, and it deals with this reliability of the proceedings, because the state doesn't have a confrontation clause right. That belongs to the defendant. But it seems like the state does have an interest in the integrity of the proceedings. And this judge made findings based on no evidence about the inability of these witnesses to travel, no process to ensure reliability. I mean, as I said, there could be a script written out by the defendant that Joe Schmo's reading in Colorado. There could be a gun to the head. We don't know, because there's no procedure set up to guarantee that. And that does seem to be an interest of the state. Now, how do you respond to that? Can that rise to the level of being a critical impact? Because clearly, if these alibi witnesses are to be believed, then that ends the case, and there is no review or ability to review at all the judge's ruling and allowing these witnesses to testify by Zoom.
Yeah, a couple of responses, Your Honor. First, and I'll acknowledge, I've been on the other side of this argument for the last year. But we have State v. Tate, and in Tate, the Supreme Court said that all of those concerns regarding a witness testifying at a remote location, whether or not they're going to be reliable, whether or not they're going to be credible, how a judge can make sure that there's not that pressure. There's instructions given to the jury regarding how to evaluate that testimony, and the Supreme Court said that's fine. So if it's fine in the context of a confrontation violation and a very narrow exception to the confrontation clause, I don't see any difference to having a defense witness in that same position where a district court judge is doing everything that the judge can to make sure that that witness is not being pressured or anything like that.
Well, but there's nothing right now, right? There's nothing. It's just they're going to be able to testify by Zoom. And I find that concerning, quite honestly.
So, again, I think that witness is going to testify under oath. There are ways to ensure that that witness is going
in another state.
in another state.
Not subject to the jurisdiction of this district court.
Well, again, under Tate and in a couple other older United States Supreme Court cases, the fact that they're in another jurisdiction doesn't affect it. Obviously, the state hasn't made that argument this morning. And again, we have Tate. So I agree
Tate
with Your Honor.
Tate doesn't deal with somebody who's out of state. It deals with somebody who's at home with COVID, right?
Yes, that's correct.
Yeah.
No, I agree with the court's concerns, but again, if there's an exception to the confrontation clause via Zoom and all those rely, it wouldn't matter if the person's sitting at home in Minneapolis testifying versus if they're in Colorado testifying. It's going to be the same process over Zoom. It's not more likely that someone's going to have a gun to their head if they're testifying in Denver, Colorado than in Minneapolis. So I don't see that being any sort of distinction between the two. But I understand the general concerns that it is different than in-court testimony, and that was the argument that was made in Tate, and the Supreme Court rejected that. And the Supreme Court said that we can guarantee trustworthiness of this testimony if the district court judge puts in proper parameters around the testimony. And again, as far as critical impact goes, it is only about the method of that testimony. It's not about the substance of the testimony. The district court's order wasn't regarding whether what they could testify to. The state never objected below that the substance of her testimony wasn't admissible. So as far as critical impact, we're not looking at whether or not evidence coming in regarding an alibi defense has critical impact. It's whether the difference between them testifying over Zoom on a screen versus in court, because that's the court's ruling, and that's where the critical impact would lie.
Does the nature of the testimony and its significance to the issues on the case, specifically the alibi, that it's critical, does that play a role at all in the critical impact? And if not, why not?
Two responses. One, I think our first argument is no, because, again, it's just about whether there's a difference between Zoom testimony and testifying in person. My second response is they still have the opportunity to cross-examine these witnesses. It's not like they're reading a transcript of the witnesses or some other potential confrontation clause violation. It is merely they're testifying over Zoom, have the same opportunity to cross-examine, impeach. All of the rules of evidence would apply the same way. So even if we are looking at the fact that there is going to be evidence of an alibi defense, the state can test that testimony through cross-examination. The state also discusses subpoenaing witness and that they don't have the burden of, or the defense should compel these witnesses to testify. These witnesses, it's nothing to do with whether they want to testify or whether we don't know where they are. It's all about their financial resources and their inability to travel to Minnesota to testify.
But there was no application under 611.21 to try to get the state to pay for the witnesses, right? I mean, there's no groundwork laid here at all.
There wasn't an application for that, but again, I believe it's the Butler case that the state cites doesn't require the state to pay for a witness to testify or to come in a court and testify. And also, again, because we have this Zoom option, having to go through that process, bring them up, delay the trial that way, seems like it is a very unreasonable way of handling the situation when the witnesses could testify that exact same day, be cross-examined. The jury was waiting outside ready to come in. It could have been all dealt with within a day or two versus having to go through that whole application process. And I know Your Honor mentioned the fact that there isn't evidence of indigency. The investigator for the defense the paralegal made a statement on the record regarding the fact that they had an inability to pay. It wasn't pushed. I understand that there wasn't any documentation for that, but again, we're not dealing with a confrontation clause issue where there's any sort of burden of establishing unavailability. This is an abuse of discretion standard. The district court, operates her courtroom and has the ability to make these decisions in order to have witnesses come in and testify properly. I guess at this point, if the court doesn't have any other questions, we would request that this court dismiss the appeal and in the alternative, affirm the district court's decision.
Thank you. And is there any rebuttal?
Now, thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the court. So we heard an argument up here, that the method would not affect what happens here. But we also heard, you know, that it is different. And I really want to kind of hone in on that right now. Members of the court, I think this method of testimony is different. Now, I think, you know, we're kind of dealing with two different parts of this here. First, we have to, of course, deal with the critical impact portion of the argument here, and then we also have to deal with the abuse of discretion. Now, members of the court, I do believe, you know, based upon all the case law that we saw that has been cited in the brief and my arguments previously, you know, that there are differences in terms of how the testimony comes across. Now, cross-examination was also mentioned as well, and it's mentioned, you know, that you can still do that under remote testimony. But once again, the jury is not going to be able to have the same perspective, the same ability to make those determinations when the witnesses are not in there. Now, I realize that, you know, that the courts have, you know, in certain very limited circumstances allowed for Zoom testimony. Once again, you know, one, those situations are extremely limited. And two, while I think that they were able to ensure some mode of reliability, at least according to those cases, it's important to note, you know, that I don't believe those cases said that that method of testimony is the by any means the preferred way of having witnesses elicit testimony in a courtroom.
So. And I'm sorry, you've probably answered it, but let's pretend that we're back a couple years in the pandemic, and a state wants to introduce and investigate the testimony via Zoom of an investigator who has been exposed to COVID, and the defense wants to introduce by Zoom the testimony of its two alibi witnesses in Colorado. For the investigator, the state follows Tate, right?
Correct, Your Honor.
How does it decide whether to permit the Colorado witnesses to testify by Zoom?
I think, Your Honor, I think the way that they would go about doing that is through a good cause test with finding of compelling circumstances. And I'll note, too, you know, based upon the case law, it doesn't seem like, you know, inconvenience is an adequate reason.
What about the defendant's constitutional right to present a defense? I mean, how does that play in here?
Well, Your Honor, I mean, we're not arguing, you know, that the defendant is not allowed to, you know, elicit the testimony from these witnesses. It's just the method in which they are doing it, we believe, is prejudicial to the state's case. And
so you, I mean, if we do address the merits of your argument, basically you're asking us to find that the district court should have just excluded the testimony here, the alibi testimony of the defendant, right? Because they couldn't come.
Well, I guess that would be due to their inability to come instead of, you know, having a court order saying, you know, that they're not allowed to testify at all or, you know, not allowed to, you know, present certain aspects of their testimony. Because we don't know the specifics of that at this time. But I can say, you know, if they do come in person, you know, we can figure that out, you know, as the case progresses or through motions in limine before trial.
But didn't the district court kind of do that in making the determination that they should be allowed to appear via Zoom? I mean, didn't the court sort of address all of those concerns?
Well, Your Honor, I just don't think that they did. I mean, I think, as it's been pointed out, the analysis I think was lacking in some key areas, and especially in regards to, you know, the income of the witnesses. There was no...
What would you have preferred in terms of evidence regarding the income of the witnesses?
I think, Your Honor, perhaps pay stubs would suffice. Other such evidence. Other than that, if they just sign an affidavit, perhaps, as to their income, that might be sufficient as well, but I don't think any of those things were done at all at that time. Well, thank you, Your Honor, and I'll yield the rest of my time.
Thank you. Thank you both for your briefing, for your oral arguments today. The case is submitted. We'll have a decision out in a statutory time period.